Anyway, welcome to you all. Thank you for coming along in this rather wonderful room, I still think. It's called the Founders Room. It's famous for all sorts of reasons. Over here, you have the famous Fabian piece of glasswork over here, which got lost for very many years, but found again, I think. It was in Arizona, was it? Yes. Stolen, yeah, by no doubt members of the Conservative Party or whatever. And around the walls, you've got all the great... probably the Trotskyists stole it as well, I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, all around the wall, you've got the various directors of the school. And at the back, you've got the picture of the woman who actually provided the money. It wasn't provided by George Bernard Shaw, even though he was a multimillionaire by the time he died, as you know, because his plays were so popular and they were turned into films, including My Fair Lady. Well, that's Charlotte Payne Townsend. So I was explaining, coming up in the lift, Beatrice was keen that George Bernard Shaw had a proper wife, and he found a millionaireess who also called herself an anarchist at the time, and that was... she came from Derry stroke Londonderry. But anyway, she's a remarkable person in many ways, and she provided the money, so the Shaw Library is actually named after her and not after George Bernard. Enough biography. Yeah. Just nice to have you here, as I said earlier on. What we're doing tonight actually is... under this particular title, Why Facts and Think Tanks Matter in an Age of Disinformation. There's a couple of reasons for doing this. One is because around the world at this very moment, or at least in the time zones in which they are situated, all sorts of people like us will be thinking about what the role of think tanks are. We are, in a sense, the London end of what is actually going on in Beijing, in Washington, New York, and all other parts of the world. This think tank, I don't quite know what it's called. It's actually called Global Go-To Think Tank Reports. This has been organized now for several years by a pretty remarkable guy called Jim McGann in Pennsylvania, and he's really the energy behind this. But over the years, he's pulled together a remarkable group of people back in his old university and has created this think tank. Global emporium. I don't quite know how to describe it. And so today, the annual results have been released. They were released this morning, and some of you may have seen them already. We've sent them out, of course. They always say about league tables that you denounce them and think they're a waste of time when you come 50th, but you think they're a great idea when you came second. And so we're very pleased to announce that this year, I'll say it now, I'm very pleased to say that this year, as last year, we've come second in the world of all university-affiliated think tanks around the world. That's out of about nearly 100 university-affiliated think tanks. There are, by the way, over 8,000 think tanks all over the world. Some of them may do some thinking, and many of them may not. So I'm not going to vouch for all 8,610 of them, but they're all over the world doing all sorts of things. But we do what we do here in LSE Ideas, and we've been doing it now for 10 years with support of the staff within LSE, supporters on our advisory group, one of whom at least is speaking here this evening, great, and some in the audience, our students, our alumni, and many, many more. So I just want to vote thanks on behalf of myself as the director and also Professor Koch, who's sitting in the front row, the other director. Say thank you very much to all of those who have made this achievement possible. Everybody said, well, who came number one? I said, oh, I suppose it was Harvard. Yes, it was Harvard. It was the Belfer Center again, Harvard. But as I say, value for money, Harvard has a $40 billion endowment, and I haven't managed to quite get that out of our director yet. So I'm working on it. Wouldn't it be terrible if we did get a $40 billion endowment and we still came second? But we're not. We certainly
don't
wouldn't.
Worry.
Don't worry. Don't worry. Anyway, with no further ado and no more frivolity from this side of the table. By the way, my name is Mick Cox. I don't have to have a label, I'm told. Richard says this because I'm far too famous anyway. I don't believe a word he says, but I'm going to believe what he's going to say over the next 10 minutes or so. So what we're going to do is get four very different kinds of people to kind of think about think tanks and why they matter and what the problems are confronting them in what we call, and I think seriously call, the age of disinformation. I'm going to start with Sir Richard Mottram, who worked with us in Ideas for many years, and before that, many jobs across the road there in Whitehall, and he's going to reflect on that. We're then going to move on to Mary Martin, who works with us in Ideas on UN and the relationship between the UN and the private sector, and her reflections on working in a think tank and what that means. I'm then going to turn to Linda Yu, who you all know, a political economist, written on China and Asia, is now a visiting professor in LSE Ideas. And last but by no means least, Vlad Zygarov. He's the student, by the way. I have to keep saying that because he said, anyway, you're the student, okay. So he's going to reflect the student experience, whatever that is. But Vlad, very nice to have you here this evening. And Vlad has been doing some fantastic work with us, by the way, working in Romania on issues of democracy, human rights, and other issues there. So Vlad, thank you very much for coming along tonight. So no further ado, I wonder we'll warm the room up with a round of applause and welcome Sir Richard Mottram. Richard, there we go.
I always think it's better if you clap at the beginning, because then you're not embarrassed at the end when you don't feel like bringing your hands together. I should say for the people who don't know me that I was from 1968 to 2007 a civil servant in the UK civil service, and I worked in a number of departments, including defence and things to do with intelligence and just about everything, you know. And so what I thought I'd do this evening is just say some things which come from the perspective of, to an extent, people who work in government. Now, at the beginning of this, I thought, well, you've got this title, Why Facts and Think Tanks Matter in an Age of Disinformation, which has obviously got three elements: why facts matter, the age of disinformation, and then the think tanks. And I think it is worth teasing out what we mean here by facts, because I looked up the definition of a fact, and a fact is a thing that is known or proved to be true. A thing that is known or proved to be true. And if you think about the currency of government, what government is all about, how it acts inside itself and with the public and so on, even leaving to one side issues of disinformation, not much government stuff is actually facts. A lot of it is not facts because government operates in conditions of uncertainty. It has data about itself, which some of which is factual, a lot of which is actually not factual. Most of its policy making is looking to the future, which by definition is not really fact-based. And then in relation to other countries, it relies on a whole pile of means of trying to get to understand them, many of which are not about facts. So facts matter, but I think that what we should really be focusing on here is how government deals with information more broadly defined, some of which may not be factual. Secondly, I thought, well, do we live in an age of disinformation? And I think that another way of expressing that is that the word of 2016, the most important new word of 2016, was the word post-truth. And the word post-truth meant circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. Okay? So when you say to yourself, do we live in an age of disinformation? If you think about that in the context of post-truth, I said to myself, well, have we not lived in ages in the past that had this characteristic, and what lessons might we learn from what happened then, and how far are those lessons relevant to today? You can think of a whole period between the wars where there was an awful lot of age of disinformation. So what might be different this time is the channels of communication that are being used in this age of disinformation. Now, you might think about disinformation also in a second sense, which is around warfare. So we now have hybrid warfare, we have countries invaded but denied that they were invaded, we have aircraft shot down, we have the evidence denied, then we have the evidence proved, counter-disinformation, also through the web. So how far is this too a new thing which we need to think about differently, and how far does that also have antecedents in the past? And the LSE has, I think, done some very important work. LSE Ideas has done some very important work trying to tease those things out. Then thirdly, I will eventually get to the subject, but I'm just sort of wandering around the context. Is this an age of disinformation that applies everywhere in the world? So is this a universal age of disinformation which people find disagreeable? I've just been in Cuba for 2 weeks. I lead a very tough, difficult life as a former civil servant. And what was very striking to me in Cuba was there were queues for two sorts of things. One, queues for bread, for reasons that we could discuss, which are quite interesting. Two, queues to obtain internet cards so that you could access the internet. And these cards allowed Cubans to access the internet on one basis. And the card I had allowed me to access the internet on a second basis. Now, in this country, all the argument is about, in this age of disinformation, can we do something to restrain the capacity of people to access things on the web which are really quite disagreeable? In a Cuban context, I suspect they'd really like to access the web on our basis. So we might ask ourselves, is this a universal phenomenon where the rules are the same for everyone? Now, what is clear is that, obviously, in the US and the UK and other countries, there has been a transformation in the way in which politics is conducted. And you have to ask whether this transformation is in any way desirable. According to the Washington Post fact checker, in the 2 years of his presidency, President Trump has told only 7,600 lies. 7,600 lies. And I think those are lies which are really about facts, as narrowly defined, as opposed to broader opinions. He, as we know, he governs by tweet, and he's now opened up, because I used to be chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee, a most interesting way with dealing with his intelligence people by basically ridiculing them in public. So if they offer an opinion about Iran or whatever, just to take that as one example, he says they're wrong, perhaps intelligence should go back to school. So here we have government by tweet on a most extraordinary basis. And things haven't reached that pitch in the UK, but nevertheless, I think you can see in the context of Brexit, for example, in the whole of 2 weeks in Cuba, I never spoke once about Brexit. It was amazing.
Are you having Brexit withdrawals?
No, I'm just coming back to it now, and it's going to be terrible. In the context of Brexit, there was obviously a very interesting argument about facts and non-facts. And there was a disdain for expert knowledge. That one of the most cerebral members of the British government said people have had enough of experts. So imagine what the less cerebral people felt about it. And there was a serious problem about falsehoods. So if you think about the striking, the most obvious winning slogan of the Brexit campaign, it was on a bus, so we all saw it. It was that Britain sent the EU £350 million a week. Now, the people who put that on the bus knew it to be false. I know this from talking to them. They didn't mind that it was false. They particularly liked, in a way, that because it was false, it was constantly being challenged so as to keep in the public eye and the public domain a link between two things, sending money to the EU and the National Health Service. So here you have quite an interesting problem where you have claim and counterclaim, where the claim and counterclaim process are feeding to produce non-factual, non-helpful dialogue, and we need to ask how our media handle those sorts of issues. Now, in this context, in the UK, I'll come briefly back to the US in a minute, there's a question to be asked, which is the one that occurs to boring old people who used to be civil servants, which is whether we are experiencing such a fundamental change in the way in which people think about the nature of evidence and its use, that it calls into question the idea that some of us spent our whole lives working on of evidence-based policy development. So, you know, we can get into the detail of this, but we won't do it now in my introduction, but, you know, there are plenty of decision-making models that apply both in domestic and foreign policy, which are all taught in the LSE, and they have an idea that there is something called evidence-based policy, and there is a clear way of generating evidence, and there is a clear way of analyzing evidence. As I say, I used to be in charge of a lot of this, and out of all of that comes strategy. That notion is, I think, fundamentally at risk. And it's obviously very much at risk in the United States, but I've noticed even in the dialogue I have with members of Parliament that actually they are becoming much less enthusiastic about this. They believe that ideology trumps all this sort of stuff. Sorry to use the word Trump in this context, and that we should be moving from evidence-based policymaking to policy-based evidence-making. And quite clearly, that is the position that's been reached already in the United States. So the question is that where we're going? Now, Secondly, if you're going to have an effective political system, that requires people to be held to account. If they're going to be held to account, there has to be a shared understanding of what it is they're trying to do, the basis on which its performance can be measured, etc. That, too, is at risk in this process. So then we come lastly to the striking thing in the Brexit debate and subsequent to Brexit has been the paucity of information offered up by government about the trade-offs involved, the risks, the timescales and how they relate to any in any meaningful way to strategy, etc., the impact of different scenarios and what they would imply, and so on. All of this information would, in an ideal world, be available to the public, who could then much better judge some of these issues. The issues have basically been obscured because the strategy is in some meaningful way not deliverable. Now, in that context, what you have is a whole set of issues, if we just took the UK as an example, about our future and our future international orientation and our future trade policy and our future defence policy and how we operate in this new wonderful world of global Britain, all of which are, in my view, underdeveloped, ill thought out, and desperately need contributions from outsiders who can force government to clarify its thinking, work with government in ways which the LSE Ideas is already doing, to encourage more structured approaches, more careful approaches, etc. So all is not lost, but we live in a very difficult age, and we live in an age where that contribution of think tanks, which is very much the space that LSE Ideas operates in, is going to be of fundamental importance.
Thank you very much, Richard. Excellent. And we move on straight away to Mary, Dr. Mary Martin. Mary?
Thank you, Mick. I also had a previous life, not as distinguished as Richard's.
Mine is distinguished.
As a journalist and as briefly a director of communications. So I thought I would just offer a couple of comments using that experience and sitting where I now sit about the, if you like, the marketplace for information and ideas, what an academic might call, hopefully still, the public sphere. And the fact that this is particularly crowded and fragmented. So a marketplace, of course, by definition, is competitive, and I think it's defined not only by the substance of facts and evidence and analysis, the kind of things that Richard was talking about, so the content, but I'm also interested in how content is circulated and how dissemination, acts of dissemination themselves, shape public discourse. So I think in this respect, it doesn't just matter what, say, think tanks can produce, but how they talk about policy and politics. And so my first comment, I think, is about how think tanks can frame and how contributions to public debates get framed in this environment, this contemporary context. Self-evidently, think tanks occupy a ground that's somewhere between, or should occupy a ground that's somewhere between policy making and legislation, purely academic knowledge, populist views, journalism. If you go down the spectrum, what editors like to use to call in journalists in newspapers, saloon bar rhetoric, or what you might hear in the back of a taxi, or nowadays in virtual space, on Facebook or whatever. And I could add two other forms that are particularly relevant to today's communications. One is advertising, obviously commercial language, where ideas and evidence are manipulated in order to sell something to us. And the second is culture and the creative arts, TV, film, theater. So what we see now, I think, is these what were once quite discrete components of public space and discourse have bled into each other. So they've become less distinct and differentiated. And of course, we all converge around the mode of social media. So as Rich was mentioning, we get policy by tweet, which has reached its apotheosis with the current White House incumbent, but we notice other leaders too mimicking and copying him. So I think one argument to consider is, if you're thinking about think tanks, how far should they resist this conflation of different kinds of communication registers? And can we have a more informed public debate by emphasising that discrete perspective that different entities, how think tanks can say something in a different way, relies on them delivering their contributions in a specific way that doesn't just mimic other forms of communication, but if you like, carves out a special space. And so if I draw on my different experiences of being a journalist and then being an academic who works in a university-affiliated think tank, a very good one, as Mick has pointed out with the latest rankings, I could tell you one story which maybe illustrates the difference. I had a distinguished colleague some years ago at the Daily Telegraph. She also happened to be Winston Churchill's granddaughter. Churchill, of course, the master of rhetoric and the fine phrase and how he could mobilize support for policies by a good turn of phrase. His journalist granddaughter used to give a talk to school students who were thinking about going into the business, the trade. The title of her talk was, "We don't want it good, we want it by 11 o'clock. So in a nutshell, you have the premium that journalism puts not just on speed, but instantaneity, immediacy, if you like. And of course, journalism has other values that it applies to disseminating information, resolution and drama being two. So journalists crave definitive outcomes. Who can be blamed for a mistake? You know, which minister is going to resign or which executive should fall on his sword? And any attempt at daring to rethink or adapt policies to a changing circumstance is branded as U-turn or flip-flopping. I noticed after the latest sort of debacle down the road and the Commons vote this week, the BBC News headline the following morning, they chose to go with the prospect that the PM was heading for a confrontation with Brussels over, you know, taking the plan back to them. Now, journalists, and I know there's some former ones sitting in the audience as well, they'd of course challenge my implication that they cannot be both fast and accurate. But I think my point is that there is an inevitable trade-off between quality and the need to deliver information fast and first. And that represents a specific and valuable, not invaluable, or non-valuable, contribution to public debates. News journalism, of course, is a specific category, and it vies for attention with hyperbole and a sort of permanent sense of crisis and zero-sum games. And in this competitive marketplace, it's all too easy to slide into this way of framing information. But the risk, of course, is what we've seen already, that public debate becomes polarized and partisan, and it's prey to catchy slogans for their own sake that actually mean little but somehow become significant nonetheless. Take back control, make America great. I mean, I'm sure we've all got our own favorites. So my feeling is that these become then springboards for disinformation that we're kind of considering tonight. So definitely there's a need to resist lazy vocabularies and straw men debates. And I think in this respect, think tanks have the potential to be that counterweight to politicians and journalists' need for delivering instant gratification. I think the idea of sustained debates as well, rather than a constantly shifting news cycle, something that's a drama today is gone tomorrow. We never sort of sit on one point. You know, we don't have time to perhaps consider the evidence and the analysis because we've all moved on if we're looking at the news cycle, and in a way that sort of overlap between the politicians and the journalistic cycle. So the ability to be, if you like, counter-cyclical and pursue unfashionable topics, yet introduce new perspectives which might reflect subtle changes in the policy context, is a huge advantage that think tanks have over both journalism and political debate. So we don't have to make it by 11 o'clock, but we do have to make it good. And my second point, I think, relates to the fact it's not just a crowded marketplace, it's a fragmented marketplace. And tracking governance itself, political discourse has moved away from being predominantly at the national government level. It's moved up to international institutions, to global business, to global NGOs, and it's, of course, moved downwards to individual citizens and grassroots organizations helped by modern communications and social media and so on. So how does that fragmentation change the ratio between information, disinformation? Just to give one example, maybe, you know, one can discuss this further in later on in the Q&A, but in my program, which is about the UN, business, and security and development, we work on ideas to encourage responsible contributions by the private sector to difficult issues like security and development, areas which have traditionally been the preserve of the nation state, but in the last two decades have opened up to civil society, to private companies, even individual citizens. And the UN itself has numerous counterparties now, not only its member states, but also business partners, activist groups, and so on. So this means, for example, in our program, we have a number of different audiences for our proposals and our analysis, not just the public sector at multiple levels, local and national government, the UN, so on, but of course the private sector itself. And the private sector isn't a homogenous entity. You get transnational corporations, you get business associations, you get small businesses. These are very different kinds of actors. And sometimes we have to physically separate those audiences because they each have very different views. Often they're quite inimical to each other. So you conduct, if you like, parallel, rather diplomatic-like sort of proximity discussions. Yet the point is that our fundamental analysis and how we use our evidence has to be the same, and it has to be true to the facts, and it has to be true to the methodology that we've chosen. If we attempt to overly manage that evidence or tailor, if you like, core messages to each of the different constituencies, we risk a possibility of disinformation, I think, or at least warped information. So playing to the audience, or at least manipulating it, as other actors do, whether they're politicians or journalists, I think it's a really dangerous game which risks losing trust and losing legitimacy. So my final plea, if I sound a bit like a Luddite, I don't mean it. I don't want to ignore new communication channels or shrink from thinking about how best we can convey our knowledge in a way that, to use a sort of term that higher education institutions love these days, to be impactful. But, you know, recognize that think tanks in particular have a particular role and strengths that really shouldn't be squandered in thinking about the current environment.
Thank you very much, Mary. And we'll move on then to Linda. Linda, you. Linda.
Thank you, Mick. Well, firstly, congratulations to you and to Christopher for an extraordinary achievement. I think it's well deserved. It's a real privilege and a pleasure to be working with LSE Ideas. And he didn't pay me to say that. But it genuinely has been, and this is why. I'm going to limit my comments to three points, and I'm going to tell you why LSE Ideas as the third point. So the first point I'm going to talk about is technology. Second point is the backlash against expertise. The third point I'm going to make is think tanks are essential. Think tanks like LSE Ideas, which translate evidence-based policies into an accessible form, is essential to democracy. So, first point on technology. How many of you have seen Friends? Okay, yeah, reruns, an old classic, just admit it. It's, you know, some of us watched the first run of it, but let's not go there. Mm-hmm. Do you remember an episode where Joey is sitting in his flat and he's kind of doing the usual Joey thing, and an encyclopedia salesman comes up and says, hey, you know, do you want to buy an encyclopedia? Okay, now, when's the last time you consulted an encyclopedia? Okay, some of you are not even nodding. Do you know what an encyclopedia is?
And so,
there was a time. By the way, if you were born before 1985, you remember a world in which the internet wasn't pervasive. So that's the digital divide. Only come talk to us if you were born before 1985 afterwards. No. My point is, it's extraordinary how technology has disrupted information. So we all know about disintermediation, and technology has literally disrupted the flow of information in our society. It used to be you'd have to buy an encyclopedia or go to the library to seek knowledge. You read the papers. And there was an implicit degree of trust that the information there was trustworthy, authoritative. But with the advent of technology, you have the bonus of, I literally can walk out onto the street and I'm always lost, so you know, I can Google and it'll point me, you know, to wherever I need. I can find out whatever I need. Mm-hmm. But I think the downside with this disintermediation is that there's too much information, and so, in a sense, it's almost like this is how the EU, by the way, gets described, which is they're very transparent. They like to say they have everything published online, but there'll be like a million pages. You're literally buried in information. And that's a problem. That is a problem because most people, you know, normal people do not sit there all day becoming experts in foreign policy, in economic policy, in security policy, you know, understanding the conflict in the Middle East, what's happening in China. It's too much information. So the role of intermediation is to have trusted sources. That's actually how democracy functions. So technology, of course, has a plus side, but this is one of the results of it. And so that takes me to sort of the backlash against expertise. I wouldn't attribute the backlash against experts all due to the fact that people have information at their fingertips. And I know people who've taught themselves how to cook watching YouTube, you know. It's possible. I don't know how good it is, but you know, you can learn online. In fact, actually, learning online is one of the most exciting things you can do in terms of, you know, in many respects. I mean, but I think I wouldn't attribute the sort of feeling that experts are not experts. Anyone has this information, and we can make, you know, we can decide ourselves whether something is true or not. Robustly examined or not, but I think the digital age has also, and there's lots of facets of this. This is not a comprehensive answer. I think it's shortened the time of discourse. Okay, I'm not blaming everything on Twitter. you know, you have to be emphatic if you are on Twitter. You used to only have 140 characters. So that sort of lends itself to these exchanges where people overstep in terms of their expertise. They overclaim. And in fact, that's one of the things experts never do. The more you know, the less you know. Everything has a qualification. And that sometimes gets lost because in the digital age, to be heard, you almost have to keep it, and this is actually what President Trump is very good at, delivering short messages, but maybe there's not that much he knows that he doesn't really know, you know. So I think that's part of it as well. And I think there's a complicated dynamic that comes with this. And to be honest, a lot of social science, there are no right or wrong answers. There are answers on which you make a judgment. That's the bulk of the evidence. That was what my informed decision analysis would be. but it's not a natural science. There is no gold standard. You can't just say, conduct an experiment and say gravity exists. Social science is much, much harder to do in that respect. So economics, my field, I'll give you an example. Paul Samuelson, who is a great economist, literally one of the towering figures of the 20th century, he was asked by a mathematician to give him an economic truth. So 50 years later, this is a true story, he came up with the concept of comparative advantage, this idea that countries shouldn't aim for a trade surplus. They should specialize, and then they should exchange, and they should specialize in what they're relatively least inefficient at. And after he explained it to the mathematician, Samuelson observed, comparative advantage is an undeniable economic truth, except it's not obvious to intelligent people. So the one truth we have can't be explained. And so I think that's also what we've lost with disintermediation, trusting people's judgment based on their research, their track record, or their experience. So finally, that to me is where think tanks like LSE Ideas comes in, because there is a massive need for trustworthy sources of information. And let me add one more caveat. I think one of the reasons also you have a backlash against expertise is that it's actually very difficult to understand experts. Some of the best experts are incredibly good at explaining their subjects simply. So if you read Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time, you may feel you know some astrophysics by the end of it if you can make it through it. But a lot of expertise has become very specialized and technical, and I know economics, and that's certainly the case. It's inaccessible. And yet, what do we all want when we graduate or when we retire? Well, hopefully a pension, a job. These are all economic policy decisions that some policymaker takes. So we need to understand what the evidence is. We need to understand what the impact is of a particular policy, where it's worked, where it hasn't worked, why we should support it. And so some of the work that we're doing in terms of foreign economic policy is exactly in this area at LSE Ideas. So think tanks provide a trusted source of intermediation because they're understandable, and I think understanding, having forums like this to understand how you do it in an age in which you have digital disruption is absolutely essential. And if we don't get this right, then democracy descends into probably some form of, everyone decides everything by what they've read online because they don't trust the official experts and sources. And we're not going to end up with great policies, great decisions. And in fact, one of the reasons we have a representative democracy is because direct democracy, where people, busy people with lives, contributing productively to society, busy people do not have time to vote on every single piece of legislation. It is intended for elected representatives. That is their job. But if we all decide we don't trust them and we don't trust the intermediaries, then you could end up in a system where we all just want to decide individual policies. And that is not a recipe for good governance. So to me, think tanks are essential to democracies. And I think by being here today, perhaps you'll help spread this message. Because that's the other thing, by the way, social media. You know, things can go viral. You can make a change. You can actually change debates. You can change the way people view things. It's one of the most exciting times. Just have to learn how to avoid fake news, alternative facts, and all those things. A few things to avoid. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Linda. And last but by no means least, Vlad Zagar.
Thank you, Professor. It seems I only have 2 more minutes for me to speak, and I'll try to make the best of it. Thank you for offering me the opportunity to be on this panel tonight. It's such a distinguished company. It's a great privilege for me because I don't really do these things very often. What I usually do is work hard, long hours for the betterment of society, for knowing the causes of things, and for making ideas great again and again, as we proved this year too. I want to start with our program, the program I'm running in LSE Ideas. It's called the Central and Southeast European Program, and it focuses on the region. And this came about last year when Professor Coker joined the management of Ideas, and he proposed this to Professor Cox, the co-director, and to Dr. Emilia Knight, and they gave the green light. So why this program on this region? I mean, I think most of you are aware of the situation that's been developing there for the last almost a decade now, starting in Hungary and going to Slovakia, Poland, Romania, Bulgaria, and most of the countries there. It's a liberal challenge to the democratic order, to the values that all these countries acquiesced to after the fall of communism, which is 30 years this year since the collapse of the Soviet bloc. It's a very important commemoration. And, well, all these changes, at first, they were not taken too seriously because everyone thought that in the 90s, all those countries were securely fastened in the Euro-Atlantic belt. So everyone focused on other regions of the world, China, Africa, and so on. No one cared about. There was a transition going on, but they were on the course. Clinton said, stay the course, the future is yours. Well, now we're living the future, and it's a very interesting future, and it's developing in a different direction for what we thought even 10 years ago. So before 1989, 30 years ago, I could say it was a fake news society. The state was the one disseminating this fake news to the people. Then again, no one believed, well, almost no one believed those news in that society. But now it's more insidious because it comes from all these different outlets and people don't have necessarily the education to distinguish between this half-truths, made-up stories and so on. So there's a bombardment of this fake news going around, disinformation. The geopolitical situation of the region is very important. You have strongman regimes around, such as Russia, Turkey, pressing on this region. So it's very difficult, for example, from someone who's in an academic environment or an NGO environment in any of those countries to stay on the course, because all these pressures coming first of all from your own government. It's a case of Hungary, most of all, Poland, enacting laws against freedom of academic freedom, expression, what you can write and cannot write, what offends the state. So all these things reverberate in a way for that region and the people in that region that may not to others, because people of my generation know what their parents went through. They had to fake it too. They have to believe what they were otherwise wouldn't believe, just to get ahead in life. And so the children of that generation don't really want to do the same thing. So it is a bit of a desperate situation nowadays on the ground. It's kind of a matter of survival for those many organizations that really want to adopt this Western way of developing institutes of research, freedom of speech, academic independence, and so on. And they have to navigate now in this backlash from their own governments, from sources within their own societies, and also from very, very strong pressures from the outside. I mean, only in Romania, I was talking to my friends there, and they're saying, Russia today is increasing the presence on radio, on the internet, YouTube, Sputnik News, Moldovan channels. It's all pervasive. It's a very difficult environment for someone to try to make ahead of things, well, especially in the institution that wants to adopt a Western liberal approach to research, education, and so on. And I think that's where LSE Ideas and think tanks such as LSE Ideas come to the fore, because why we went there is because there was demand for us. And there was also, so we offered what was requested. People would like connectivity with such think tanks, because first of all, they offer international dissemination of their research, which the work they're doing there is absolutely amazing. So all the researchers I've met, I've been there with Professor Coker in the autumn. We met wonderful researchers, wonderful centers. They're on the ground. They know what they're doing. But there's a political pressure. And if it's not political pressure, it becomes self-censorship. Because maybe if you say something, you won't get any more funding. And if you're all alone in your little bubble there's no one to hear you scream. So that's why I think it's very important for a think tank such as the LSE to increase their connectivity and support to this type of organizations, be it academic universities, be it NGOs, civic groups, anything. Anything is a big thing for people. I've traveled around the region. I used to work in auction house, which dealt with the same region, so I went around all those countries, and I've talked with so many people. And it's a general trend. It's not something Romanian or Hungarian, or it's a different levels of development, or well, whatever. It's and that's why I think we grouped this region together, because they have a common history. It's 100 years since the Treaty of Versailles, which really left an imprint. Again, the fall of communism, 30 years. So it's a year, very interesting year, 2019, to address all these questions. And I think it's ideas is in the position to assist, because there is a need, and we can provide a lot of assistance to those in need. I think I can finish on that.
Okay, thank you very much, Vlad. That's excellent. Thank you very much indeed. We've got plenty of time for discussion. Can I just raise two or three quick points myself? On one of the themes of the backlash against experts, I suppose one could say, well, the experts had it coming. I always use the story, and you know it very well, when the Queen came here, when we were opening the new academy, I had to make this story, didn't I, Kater? When the Queen came and then turned to a professor and said, well, why didn't you get the 2008 crisis right? Why didn't you anticipate the possibility of such a crash? 6 months later, 30 economists wrote a letter to The Guardian. You know, it makes the point. And I mean, I suppose one of the reasons why the experts are in under attack, and I agree with you, basically all of you, that it's a very dangerous moment when you say that expertise is the problem. But in a way, the experts, many of the experts at least, have had it coming. I believe, you know, I mean, distance from, you know, the lives of ordinary people. And there were so many experts who kind of thought that we could never actually have a crash as in 2008. And I suppose, in a way, it's coming home. So I think we've got to understand where that's coming from, even if we don't agree with it. You know, Trump was actually, typically, and as I've always said, highly underestimated politician. We don't underestimate him now, by the way, I noticed. But again, what Trump said, well, all these experts, you know, they kind of told me you've knocked over Iraq, that would be okay. They didn't predict the 2008 crisis, you know. So I think, you know, there is a sense in which, although we want to defend expertise, and I obviously do, we've got to understand where this backlash has come from. And we bear, if you like, some of the responsibility for where we are today. That's my mea culpa, not too maxima, but culpa at least. The other thing is about playing to the audience, which was a point made, I think, which was an important one. We don't want to play to those. I think that was your point, Mary. I think the wider problem, another problem at least, I would say, is not playing to the audience, but in a sense, playing to the person who pays your bills or the government that subsidizes you. I think you bring this out very well there, Vlad. I mean, one of the problems that think tanks have faced, and many do face, and I wouldn't even call them think tanks in the proper sense of the word, is that they clearly are simply, you know, amplifiers either of government propaganda or the views of certain corporations who just want to push a particular line. And I think this strikes me again as something. And the question of independence, it does seem to me, is one that it has to be defended, you know, however difficult it is, because if it isn't, then your credibility goes completely. Because and one of the things we've tried to do in Ideas, and I won't go into too much detail, but there is a whole organization called Transparify, which looks very carefully, you know, where is your funding coming from? Who are your sources of influence, you know, subterranean and all the rest. But I think, again, I'd really emphasize this whole the really great importance of independence and how you maintain that. And also, by the way, and we've talked about this in Ideas, and it's something you can't avoid, you can't function without money. I mean, you can't function without material support. But the question is, where do you get it from? How do you get it? How do you keep a distance between the money that comes in that supports you? We don't get a great deal, by the way. We don't, certainly don't get the $40 billion that comes into Harvard, if only. But, you know, you on the one hand, you're kind of caught between having the necessity of needing the material resources to do what you want to do, on the other hand, not being captured in any way by those sources of support. And, of course, in certain countries, of course, you're already captured by the state. One final very quick point on, you made the point about post-communist societies. I always make this point. I was a Sovietologist. I should write a book about it one day. Memoir of failure. But I do think, and I mean, again, pointing the finger at Russia, you know, is too easy. But nonetheless, I mean, putting China to one side just for the moment, I mean, Russia is playing an absolute screamer of a game, you know, without any doubt whatsoever. I mean, you watch RT, you look at Sputnik, you know, you listen to what's said. It's having an impact. There's absolutely no doubt. It's having impact both on what you might call the right of politics. And by the way, also on the left of politics, because they're very, very clever the way they play this particular game. And then the influence it's then having, and again, I'm not one of these kind of, let's have another Cold War because it's a good idea. But, you know, I mean, the realities are that if you go to places like Serbia, you go to even, you know, other parts of the world, in Western Europe as well, and Hungary and places like that, Romania you've already mentioned, you know, they're really at the game. And they're playing the game, you know, with a great degree of ruthlessness and skill. And I think maybe we're waking up to it now, but we need to wake up to it a good deal more, it seems to me, in the future. Anyway, on those few reflections, again, I thank all the four speakers. I think we could now open it up for general contributions and questions. Who would like to set the ball rolling? We do have a microphone, but who would like to go first? Who would like to, Janet? We'll start it. We've got two at the front here, please. Hi. If you could just quickly introduce yourself. Thank you.
Hugh Sanderman, LSE Ideas. I liked your point, Linda, when you said very clearly at the end that think tanks can, and I assume you mean should also, aim to change debate. Because I'd be very interested in hearing from the panel about the impact that think tanks should strive to have, and secondarily, of course, a boring issue with a lot of NGOs, how they might go about assessing that impact without too much bureaucratic stuff behind it.
Thanks, Hugh. I think Christopher, I think you had your hand up, did you? If you could, Christopher Coker.
Shall I stand?
I think you ought to. Yeah. Good-looking fellow like you, I think, ought to be shown to the public.
Yeah. Christopher Coker, expert, and also
unabashed,
unreconstructed.
That's good.
Co-director of Ideas. Mick, you will know this very well. That the origins of postmodernism, of course, is based on Nietzsche's idea that there are no such things as facts; there are only interpretations. Yeah. I also address you because, of course, you're a great fan of E.H. Carr, who famously, in his small set of lectures on what is history, said that historians establish the facts retrospectively. So basically, everyone has been crossing the River Rubicon for years, and then in 53 BC, a senator called Julius Caesar, admittedly with a private army, crosses the Rubicon and starts the Civil War. But as Carr said, historians in future generation looking back may think that other people who'd crossed the Rubicon were actually more significant than Julius Caesar and the Civil War. And it reminds me of the Don DeLillo's wonderful construct of the Morehouse Professor of Latent History. This is history that has happened, but nobody's actually noticed it. Yeah. And the Morehouse professor in question, of course, has written a thesis on the influence of guano on history.
Guano.
And not guano, in fact, very important if you come from Chile. Nobody has actually noticed the importance of guano, but one day they will. And what did we wake up to this morning on BBC News? But the way that the colonization of the Americas represented and led to significant global climate change. So, my question to you, of course, as a former expert now, right, because I completely undermine my credibility, is that we have been dealing with misinformation. all this time. And now we have disinformation. And it's a serious question, quite frankly, because as I told my students today, in the last 10 years, historians have noticed the significance of global climate change in history for the last 4,000 years. Nobody wrote about it. Nobody noticed it at the time, apparently, but it's taken historians to do so. So to what extent are facts retrospective, and to what extent can we actually grasp them now? And to what extent is misinformation as much a problem as disinformation?
Okay, thank you very much, Christopher. We'll take any more questions to go to start off with. Yes, the lady there, please. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I do a master in media and communication here at LSE, and my question to my question is that LSE Ideas is a great think tank, but unfortunately not all think tanks around the world are like LSE Ideas. Some of them are confidential about their funding and are actually partisan, and they support or disseminate fake news, which is not supposed to happen at all, especially from think tanks. So how can we, for example, as a trusted think tanks, kind of help or allow for more model like us to exist kind of around the world, because there is a great need for LSE ideas, for think tanks like LSE ideas around the world. Thank you.
Thanks very much. There's three to go, I think. We'll take those three. One on the impact of think tanks, then a very complicated question from Christopher, but one I think I understood, mis- or disinformation and retrospection. And finally, well, Christopher and I have wonderful forms of communication, don't you worry. And then finally, he wants me to go on to E.H. Carr, this is one of my favourite topics. And then, what are the think tanks, and, you know, are they really think tanks in an independent sense of the world, and what can we as a think tank and think tanks in the West do to help others? I think that's the import of your question. Who wants to start off with? Richard, why don't you come back into the conversation?
Well, as long as I'm not required to say anything about Christopher's question. I will say one thing, actually. When I was thinking about what I was going to say this evening, and I got into the question of, you know, what is truth and what are facts, yes, postmodernism reared its beautiful head, and I thought, I'm not going to go there. So I was trying to make a non-philosophical point about the nature of government business not being tightly factually defined, without getting into the question of whether there is such a thing as objective truth. And then I would, something about which I used to know something, but I've long since forgotten. I suppose the question, my question back to you, Christopher, would be, well, you know, the world of politics is always involved, and the world of international relations and diplomacy and intelligence and counterintelligence has for long since involved both misinformation and disinformation. And so I don't think that what we now face is something that is in that sense strikingly new. I think it's, as Linda was talking about, it's the channels of communication have changed the nature of the way in which some of this is conducted. But if we went back to the Cold War, we could see that both sides were engaged in combinations of misinformation and disinformation. Beyond that, I don't want to go. If I could just make a point about Hugh's question and comment, I think that, and looking at it from the point of view of government as a customer, so to speak, then I think traditionally, if I went back through my own career, I would say that much of which was spent in the Ministry of Defence, so this may come as a bit of a surprise to people, what I'm about to say, was that when I was in the Ministry of Defence in the period up until around 2000, really, the Ministry of Defence had a strong sense, which I think it still has to an extent, actually, that it needed outside advice which was expert, and that if it was going to have that outside advice that was expert, it had to build a set of confidential relationships with people who it would share information with on a trusted basis without suborning and corrupting them along the lines that you were the danger that you were rightly drawing out, Nick. And it developed such relationships. So it had very close relationships with IISS, to an extent with Chatham House. It developed, it created and developed relationships with King's College and funded them for a while, and still funds them massively, actually, through various means. So I think that there is a challenge for a think tank like LSE Ideas, which is being pursued, is can you build these trusted relationships with government where you are not suborned, corrupted, required to come up with answers which they want to hear. Now, what I think is interesting about how government has developed is whether, I think that amongst officials and so on, there would still be appetite for such things. Whether amongst the political class there is an appetite for such things varies according to whether they think the answers are going to be particularly appetizing. But I would say that you can build these confidential relationships, you can get funded through them. It's probably more difficult at the moment to do that simply because of financial pressure. I don't think there's any big challenge to doing that, which makes it impossible.
Mary, any thoughts on any of that?
Some thoughts on Hugh's good question about what kind of impact and then how should you measure it. I mean, I have to say impact as a kind of statistical thing is the bane of one's life, really, because it, you know, there's that idea of that instant gratification. So impact, literally, doesn't it, means, you know, you're hitting somebody. So it's very easy if you've got a piece of research or a policy paper or some kind of brief, you manage to get it in the newspaper, you manage to get it on the Today program or whatever, instantly you can say, okay, you know, people had it. Do you really know that's what kind of impact that had? I mean, my problem with impact, it's a real buzzword, isn't it? But, you know, who is measuring it? And, you know, what about the intangibles of impact rather than the kind of instant hit that you get? And, I mean, in the sort of program that we do, a lot of the, we talk about impacts more in who gets, and this goes back to perhaps Mick's point about sort of gatekeeping and who designates themselves as experts and people who are qualified to sort of speak and kind of arbitrate in these things. So who decides what impact is, you know, and whether you've achieved it? And the kind of programs that we do, actually, it's about having it as a sort of interactive process with, say, communities on the ground. You know, how have you been affected by the projects or the funding or the development and so on? But I think this sort of token use of impact and impact statistics and weird kind of measurements that by which you justify your work actually just serve to constantly undermine, in a sense, our legitimacy and sort of put us up as more as gatekeepers and as some kind of elite who decides, you know, how these things go. So I think there is a need for, I don't know how you have them, really honest debates about, you know, what are valid impacts in any given situation for any given piece of research. And then, you know, what are appropriate measurements of it? I think just sort of blanket doing it in a statistical way is very unfortunate and probably serves us ill in the long run.
Linda, have you got any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think a lot of the issues have been well covered. So perhaps I'll just touch briefly on Hugh's and come to your question. I think in terms of what should think tanks be promoting, if think tanks are a crucial intermediary of information so people can make informed decisions about their politicians, about the choices that politicians are making, then by the transitive property, think tanks should be promoting evidence-based research, which I think is not going to be a controversial statement. So I'm going to go slightly further, which is, One of the things, and this is going to make me sound not like an economist, we tend to go for value-free, as in because we're worried about partisanship, because we don't want it to color what we do. But every researcher comes with their own lens. Everyone has their own values that lie behind it. It's actually one of the I did a law degree, and one of the most extraordinary things I still remember, besides how hard it was when you study jurisprudence, you think the Supreme Court is all about applying stare decisis, it's all about precedent, you have to look at the judges. You have to see where they sit on issues. And to me, that was the most extraordinary thing in, you know, where you think of the law as value neutral, actually, and that's not how jurisprudence is taught, because it matters. So I guess what I'm getting at is, I don't think you can actually be value free. I think there are universal values that we should all be promoting, and perhaps think tanks too. So if you believe in the universal values of human rights, equality, justice, protecting the environment, if you believe in these values, then they should infuse the kind of work that you do so that you're always promoting the healthy conversations around democracy. And I think that's ultimately perhaps what we've begun to move away from by becoming much more analytical. I still believe in being analytical. It's absolutely what we do. But just recognize that everyone has values behind what they do, and it's just better to be explicit about it, I think. And then just quickly on your point, I think, in a sort of perfectly, competitive world, the great think tanks crowd out the bad ones because, that's how the marketplace for ideas works. Yeah, that isn't actually how it works. So I think in the same way that you should be trying to influence the public policy debate towards promoting the values and principles that define us, in exactly the same way, the good independent think tanks, which are not partisan, have no agenda, are transparent, should be blaring that. That should be, completely broadcast. That's the only way to counter the others. It's not going to happen just through natural competition. I know I don't sound very much like an economist by the end of it, because there is no perfect competition in anywhere, except for fish markets, apparently. If you go to a fish market in the early morning, apparently that's the only perfectly competitive market or something like that. So, thank you.
Flat. Some reflections, because I thought you were very moving comments about what is actually happening on the ground in a real country, in a real place, in real time, Romania. All of the very great optimism that some people had, including myself, about what was going to happen post 89. Mm. How difficult is it now? I mean, you hinted at that, but I think you were probably understating how difficult it's become in quite a lot of the parts of where we hope. We look at Poland, we look at Hungary, we look at Southeast Europe. I mean, how really difficult is it? Sorry to put you on the spot, but I'm kind
of it's getting more and more difficult. Every passing month, every passing year. I've heard people talk about objective truth, facts, and so on. The impact they have. I think it's a bit more about, for example, values in the region, and I think it's about fostering those values, which have proven so far to have a positive impact on society in general, but also in this academic and NGO sphere. People are now still allowed, most of the countries, to question. They have the freedom to interpret things. Under communism, fascism before that, there were a lot of think tanks, academic institutes, but they were in-house research centers for the parties in power, so they didn't have the freedom. People were competent and so on. So the facts were there, because no one dared to question them, even if they were not facts as we would. So I think it's about values and how we interpret those facts and how those values allow us to manifest in society and in all those structures. For example, I started this program with opening negotiations with what is still the largest university in Central Europe, Central European University, still in Budapest. And I've known some people there, and I've started talking with them. and they were in very good high positions. They've been there for years in Budapest, and they started going one by one because they said they can't stay in that environment. They came into Hungary as Orban was coming to power, and they saw the degeneration and the pressures, daily pressures, all the little things, daily things that the government would have in store for them. They couldn't sleep at night. What's next in the morning? What's next in a week? What next law to curtail our freedoms and so on? So now it's on hold, the negotiations, because it seems they're moving to Vienna. So they've lost the biggest asset I think Budapest had, this vibrant academic place of debates and so on. So it's happening, and people, some people, which we are now in connection with in Romania and in other countries, that's what we're trying to prevent. So on the third question, for example, the impact on the region, we've created a cooperation with the biggest university in Transylvania, the second in Romania, in Cluj. So we've established a desk there, an LSE Ideas desk, for research on the region and on the issues from energy, migration, populism, rise of populism, democracy, everything that represents something that's today very, very important to everyone's lives. So I think it's about the values we are fostering. Also, we have a very good connection with Romania's foremost foundation, the Radu Foundation for Democracy, which we have a good cooperation starting this February. We're taking students from the LSE and from other schools around London to see the region, get to experience debates with academics from those spaces, take part in workshops, and some which are interested on maybe researching on the region could stay there and for 3-6 months and experience everything they have to offer on both academic, all aspects of student life. So this is what we're trying to do, this increasing connectivity and keep the values going so people can express themselves and continue, put something else on the table, not just illiberalism and closed societies.
Yeah. Thanks, that's great. I mean, it also illustrates, you know, if we think we've got problems with information, disinformation, backlash against experts in the West, countries like the UK or France or the United States, you want to get the real thing. You know what I mean? You know, the old Soviet Union was one thing, but what we're seeing today, and I mean, you know, I don't want to specify one particular country, but let me just mention China. I mean, I was really struck. I mean, you know, I've been going back and forth for years, and I've been struck by the evolution of what's been happening in China. None of it very positive, I have to say, on the political side at all. Very worrying developments, and we've got to talk about that openly without being anti-Chinese. But I was struck too, and I don't know if anybody, because you mentioned the Central European University, which of course was the great experiment of George Soros, a very great man and a very great benefactor and certainly a great man who studied at this school under Popper. And, you know, it was his university which, you know, provided that space for a real debate in Hungary, and it's gone. Interestingly, the speech that he made in Davos very recently, George Soros, was really a very powerful statement. I mean, I think many people were rather taken aback that, you know, his attack on China, or not his attack, his critique of what he sees as the not just the economic issue. I think he put that to one side. It's, you know, what are the consequences? And I think we've got to talk very openly about that because, you know, whatever good wishes we wish to the Chinese people and, you know, the poverty reduction, the economic development, and all the other things which are very, very important part of the enormous achievements of China over the last 25 years, and they've been real. There's genuine, real achievements for that country for which one has to kind of stand back and say, well done. Nonetheless, things are happening there now which clearly, you know, run. And I think a lot of, you talk about self-censorship. I find quite a lot of self-censorship on China. You know, people just don't want to talk openly because they've, well, you know, whether it's Western guilt or whether it's because, you know, there's so much economic stake in China, that it's becoming quite difficult, I think. I don't know, put you on the spot, Linda, but I kind of sense this at the moment coming through. I don't know. This is why I quite was, A, surprised and rather welcomed what George Soros had to say. Linda, do you feel this at all or not?
I think there's quite a lot of self-censorship within China, and I think that is, you know, in its own way, a sort of explicit, you know, it's an explicit, obviously, controlling of information of only maybe you can't get tenure at a university if you study Tibet. Oh, you definitely can't if you study Tibet. I think there is self-censorship, and I think that's actually one of the most worrying trends because, by definition, the reason why researchers, academics, students love the university setting is because of free speech. And I said before, we are the values that define us. So if you think about what the other essential components of a democracy is, we talked a lot about information, and Mary touched on this. It's the free press. In fact, Mary, I think I'm right in saying there's a saying by Ben Bradley, the former editor of the Washington Post, who said, journalism is the first draft of history. So, you know, the free press is integral to this debate. And I think, you know, so in a one-party state, the tendency to not just suppress the free press, but also be in such an environment where people self-censor, I think that is ultimately not going to be, it's not great, is it? if you think about the world's second biggest economy. I absolutely think that is a big issue. Yeah.
Christopher, you just wanted to come in on one point, and there's one or two other hands that have gone up. Christopher, did you want to come in very briefly on one point? Very quick point, yeah. And then I'll bring up the other people. Okay, I've got you.
Just a very small point on Mary's point about impact. I had a discussion with a very distinguished IR professor, Ned LeBeau, the other day. has there ever been a lecture, because think tanks, of course, people give lectures. Has there ever been a lecture that has had impact, immediate impact in the world by any social scientist or scientist? And we couldn't think of anyone. But I read in that rather boring magazine called Prospect, very virtuous liberal center-left magazine, that there was such a lecture, Gödel's Theorem of Incompleteness, which he gave, I think, in 1930, which is the radical idea that there are certain mathematical proofs that cannot be proven. And it was met by total and absolute silence in the room, except by John von Neumann, who is one of the, of course, fathers of computer science, who immediately recognized its truth. And within 1 year, the entire mathematical community had accepted it. But at the time, there was total blankout because it was too radical. It was just too revolutionary. You cannot, in one lecture, have an impact, but it creeps up incrementally.
Christopher. Your lectures reverberate around the world. There's a person over here, and there's a person down here. I've got you okay, guys.
Yeah, Valentina Bingstein, also LSE Ideas, and relating to Christopher's and Mary's point, and I absolutely agree that quantitative approaches to impact assessment are not the way to go. But don't you think, as a sort of self-attack, but no, obviously not LSE Ideas, but maybe other think tanks, that there is a problem, or rather, maybe even a lack or a struggle of capability to disseminate the knowledge think tanks produce or the interpretations of reality we produce. Because there's so many distinguished think tanks with distinguished scholars writing excellent articles, but who's the audience? Who's actually reading it? And does it impact influence debates and policy making?
That's very good, yeah. In the middle here, whoever, give it to him. Yeah. I'm not going to push it around. We'll take a few together, and then we'll round up. Yeah, thanks. Thank you, Hannah. If you could introduce yourself.
Maria Beradovic, I'm a strategy consultant. I'm building on your points a little bit. In an age of disinformation, people consuming information differently, information happening much faster than before, it's becoming quite clear that just producing high-quality research isn't enough anymore, and that communications capability is becoming even more important to kind of join up and help each other out, really. At the same time, we're seeing a sustainability crisis in Africa. A lot of the big funders are pulling out. In Africa, for example, the think tank initiative, Africa Capacity Building Foundation, Gates, they're pulling back core funding. That are needed to develop these communications capabilities. To what extent or what responsibility or role do you see that these funders have to ensure that think tanks become these trusted sources of information and facts?
Great. If you could just pass it back. There's a gentleman there. Thank you. Please, if you could introduce yourself.
Yes, my name is Kofi, and I'm studying MSc African Development. So I'm wondering what the relationship between think tanks and governments have been over the years, and specifically African governments. You know, and seeing as there is a disproportionate number of these think tanks in the global north, you know, whatever policies, you know, are being made concerning specifically African governments, there's this huge distance between the think tanks and then the situations that they are analyzing. So what I'm wondering is what has been the relationship or the history between African governments and northern think tanks?
That's a great, we'll come on to that. It's a great question. There's a, pass it back, thank you. If you could introduce yourself again, hi.
Hi, my name is Milan. I graduated from LSE last year, work in branding now. I just wanted to pick up on Linda's point about the importance of good information for democracy and the role that think tanks play in that. And I kind of was thinking, how many of your average citizens actually engage with the information released by think tanks? There was this trade-off that you laid out, Mary, which was quality information versus quick information. And if think tanks are at the quality end, that's often slow. So it's some sort of rapport, it's something that's posted online. So it's kind of how do you make quality information available to your average person so that quality information has more of a role in a democracy?
Thanks very much. Great question. Did I see any other hands going up? Yeah, please try and pick up everybody, and then we'll do a round robin conclude. Yeah, so if you could say who you are.
Dan Edwards. I'm a civil servant. And thanks to the panel for a great example of a sort of a balanced, informative debate with Grace. And so we've talked a lot about the role of think tanks, and you all agree on the value of think tanks, improving the quality of information. Mm. But given particularly recent examples, can you say more on how to improve the quality of the debate itself? In other words, you know, how can people gracefully accept other people's views? How can echo bubbles be punctured without people just shouting and ranting louder and louder for more and more counterfactuals?
Okay, I think we'll conclude on that as a question. Now, why don't I start again with you, Richard, if you don't mind? You knew that was coming, didn't you?
I did, yeah.
Yeah, you did.
How can we improve the quality of debate? One of the ways in which you can try to do this is to break down barriers between different elites and the way they work. If we're taking the UK, for example. So one of the big problems, I think, in the UK is that there is increasing separation, polarization between different forms of the different elites, whether it's civil servants, ministers, academics, civil servants, ministers, etc. There is no, there are insufficient places of meeting where there is a quality discussion about serious issues which might shape and shake up the attitudes of people. So the interesting question is, can organizations like the LSE, like LSE Ideas, do something about this? Mm. And the answer to that is, in a very limited sort of way, it can. Mm. But I have a nervousness that it's very striking when you watch what's happened in Parliament over the last over the last few weeks, all of which I imbibed in one day when I came back from Cuba. Which is probably not the way to take it. There is a very serious problem in our society and in our political class that it is very, very tribal and very, very unwilling to open itself up to new ideas. So I don't know the answer, frankly, to this problem. Secondly, I don't know the answer. It's pathetic to sit on a panel and say you don't know the answer. I don't know the answer to how you get influence with key people through the generation of research-based information if you simply serve it up and expect them to pick it up. Mm. It simply won't work. Mm. So, and this is a big problem, not just for universities, it's a massive problem for research councils. I used to have responsibilities in relation to research councils. Mm. Mm. Absolutely massive problem. Mm. They're generating all this information. Much of it is of very high quality. Mm. nobody has time to look at it. Nobody, even if they understand that it's from trusted sources, can really tackle it. So you've got to find intermediaries and ways of directly bringing together people so they interact, as opposed to simply serving the information up. And lastly for me, I'd say that this is also a problem within government itself. I used to be in charge of intelligence. I could serve up wonderful intelligence assessments. Could I necessarily get people to read them and as a result of reading them to change their minds? Yeah. And again, the answer was you couldn't do that by serving it up as a document or a piece of paper or whatever. You had to find or try to find ways in which you could actually engage with people. A proposition with which I was not personally very successful. So these are fundamental problems. It's not about the quality of the research. It's not about the packaging. It's about finding channels and intermediaries and ways of engaging people.
Mary, I'm coming over to you.
Yes, I'm going to be boring and agree with Richard, because it struck me as something you said earlier too about that kind of the role of, if you like, strategic alliances or working in tandem. So you've got the knowledge production, but it's not, as you say, just lobbed out there where everybody is clamoring for attention and, you know, it gets lost, or if it gets its 5 minutes of fame. I'm not sure whether we have 5 minutes of fame nowadays or 15 minutes or 1 second, and then gets forgotten the next day. I think more sustained is the situation where if think tanks, so-called experts, people who work with evidence, have good analytical skills, you know, rigorous methodologies, think about both ideas, to coin a phrase, but also process as well, work with maybe the policymakers or somebody who's actually going to put it into practice. And I'm not saying we're a model of this, but it's quite interesting what we're trying to do with the UN in our program. This bit of the UN have only done this once before, i.e. team up with an academic institution. They did it some years ago with Brookings Institute in the States on internally displaced people. And now they're doing it with us on, you know, how do you generate ideas to mobilize and to, if you like, get more constructive engagement by the private sector. So if you like, our role is to kind of push them with some sort of sometimes provocative ideas that tests the, you know, their tolerance limits. But then at the same time, they go and actually apply it on the ground through UN agencies. So we have a kind of a, you know, dynamic where we get to test our results, our, you know, outrageous provocative ideas, or, you know, see how they work. And to me, that seems like a good use or a good partnership between the people who actually, like policymakers, who actually have to put these things into practice, so real life, with the sort of, hopefully, the originality of ideas and thinking outside the box that, you know, a think tank can do.
Okay, thanks, Mary. Linda, and then finally Vlad, yeah? Any final comments you need?
I think on the comms issue, I would repackage it. It's about promoting democracy. Good institutions requires quality information. So it's not just comms for research. This is integral to delivering the kinds of institutions we know, without which nothing else happens. Poverty eradication, disease eradication. I just repitch it. On the issue of... it's a really interesting question about why will people read quality pieces. So, you know, when you blog and you can track people, how far people read down your blog, and they stop at like 200 words, and you're like, oh, man, they only read, you know, what about the rest of the 800 words? So I think there's an element of that. But, I mean, one of the most striking things to me, so I've written some books, and one of the striking things to me is, a little while ago, there was a prediction that nobody would read books anymore because all of our attention span had been so shortened by television, and now all we want are, you know, 3-minute videos online. And yet, actually, the market for nonfiction, for books with rigor, quality writing is there. So I think, you know, I don't know the answer, but I just think, you know, the average, you know, person book reader, Yeah, I think it does take time to produce quality things, and it's not going to be last minute. And that's about changing people's expectations. It's like when I give a lecture and I put up a chart, and a student might say, but that data stops in 2015. Okay. And I'd be like, yeah, you're pretty lucky. That's pretty recent. and so, you know, but it is literally explaining what expectations are. So, and then finally, quickly, on the quality of the debate itself. That's a really good question. There is, I don't want to depress you, but there was a study that found that on certain issues, when people are emotionally vested, facts and rational arguments cannot persuade them because it generates what's called cognitive dissonance. So your rejection isn't of your belief, your rejection is of the fact. And I'm afraid there's quite a few issues nowadays that fall into that sphere. Did you watch Brexit, the Uncivil War, the documentary? Okay. So apparently that's quite a good depiction of Dom Cumming, I'm told, by people who know him. You know, he has that pie chart that says, Remainers, Leavers, ignore them. That's why. You're never going to persuade them with facts. You're only going to target the persuadable. U.S. elections are all won on the marginal voter, the independents. But the problem I see with this is that that's fine for whatever is that they're doing with elections, but that's not fine for public discourse. You cannot just write off massive populations, millions of people, because they emotively believe something. There's got to be something else that can be done. I don't know what it is, but something else has to be done. I suppose one thing is maybe stop arguing over social media and maybe meet some people, because generally speaking, when you meet somebody, you know, you're less likely to be like, you know, you're going to listen to them, you're going to hear them out. So anyways, that's my 2 cents worth. Thank you.
Vlad, any final reflections?
So, quality of the debate, audience engagement, I can just bring a few examples from our little program and on the region. So on the quality of the debate, for example, we're taking part in this. We've been invited to take part in the Ratio Dialogues on Democracy this spring in Transylvania, which is very interesting. Debate on all sorts of issues on the present day in the region and globally too, and we'll be taking part with our own workshop and a panel discussion on the engagement. As I said, we're taking students. We want to aim at taking students, undergraduate, postgraduates, to do some field work proper, not just come to ideas in Tower One in Pancras House and meet people and just go out saying they've done work. So we want to take them to see how things are happening, to speak with also policymakers, to speak with researchers, speak with NGOs involved on the ground. And because there is a demand for quality research, people want ideas to provide expertise. They want to co-author pieces with researchers from here. Students want to be engaged with people. So there is quite a lot of demand for connectivity on so many levels, and it permeates from the academic to the policy-making sphere and the NGO. So I think on our region, there is a bit of a scare that things might degenerate. Yeah. And there is a basic connectivity on so many levels. Mm.
Okay, thank you very much. We didn't answer the question about the Africa issue, which I think is a very important one. All I can do is give you one or two quick statistics. I looked at, when I was going through the material about this think tank's cycle, which is the material, it's all online, by the way, so you can go and find it. If you actually look, there's an overwhelming dominance in the think tanks, which are coming from North America and Europe, particularly Western Europe. I think they constitute between them something close to 55 to 60% of all, and by the way, they're the most influential of the think tanks as well. So it's not just a numerical number; it is also a question of the influence. So, you know, something like a Brookings in the United States or a Chatham House around up the road. You know, these are the ones that really have the impact. So it's absolutely true, and I don't give any pat easy solutions to that, but it does suggest a massive asymmetry in where the information is coming from and the absent voices and almost absent continents to some degree. I would, however, say on behalf of the people who organized this whole thing. They had, and they've been very conscious of that. Jim McGann, who we've become quite friendly with over the years, has been very conscious of the absent voices in the debates, and has been, you know, working very hard. Whether effectively is another question, but he's working very hard to at least try and bring in different voices from those parts of the world which we've not been hearing, simply because their voice is not as loud, and the amount of money they got going into it is. But it's a very well taken question on the Brexit thing. I'm sorry, but in that particular program, what did he say? He said two issues: immigrants, Turkey, immigrants. The point was being made, and they hit it again. Turkey's going to join the European Union, don't you know? You think there's a lie on the back of that, on the side of that red bus? Have you noticed Turkey joining the European Union lately or getting close? I don't think so. We've also got to, concede that, let's not just call it disinformation, downright lies, frankly were told. And, they made an impact because it touched certain people's fears and worries and concerns. Now, how much we can do to kind of combat that, I don't know, but we will do our damnedest. Anyway, on that particular note, I will conclude. A think tank is now going to turn into a drink tank. Oh, I've been wanting to say that forever, by the way. And we have a little reception at the back there for you. Please come and join us with some food. I wonder if you could put your hands together and say thank you to all the four panelists for a very good discussion. And thank you.